Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guest today is Emily Orbai, who is presently studying for a Master of Science in Psychology at Lund University. She's going to tell us a little bit about her life, why she joined the society, her views on agnosticism, Taoism, the Quakers and the Middle Way, and also why the cultivation of a sense of wonder or awe is an important factor in her life. Okay, Emily, hello and welcome to the MWS podcast.
Thank you, Barry. Thank you.
So could you start by telling us a little bit about yourself? Can you give us a bit of background about your life?
Yeah, sure. I'm Swedish. I was born in Sweden in a little village called Vittua, which is a little place of about 2,500 people or so in the woods with some lakes dotted around. It's very beautiful there. Mm-hmm. I grew up spending a lot of time outside. It's always been really important to me. Like the landscape, I felt very embedded in the landscape when I grew up. And I read a lot of books that had thoughts and ideas in them about nature and the environment and the humans interacting with nature and stuff.
Can you think of a book in particular that made a real impression on you at that time?
The Secret Garden was a big book when I grew up that I, you know, and actually that's probably the first time I heard about horticulture therapy, because that's kind of what they do to bring Mary becomes like a real person sort of when she finds the garden, and Colin learns to walk, and you know, so this is a theme that's continued, I think, probably largely because of books like that.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's some nature romanticism, of course, but it was a good counterweight to the fact that, you know, Swedish society is quite modern and efficient and Western and secular. So some of those values still managed to, you know, seep into my sort of mix there. And
Yeah. Okay. And from your childhood, then what happened then?
In school, I was a bit anxious and had some social anxiety. I think I had a sense of, like, the social games that people play, I was mature enough to see that was something that was bad, but I wasn't quite mature enough to really rise above it enough.
Right.
So that was problematic for me, but being outside and doing things outside made me feel more like a whole person, strong and free, I guess.
Yeah.
So when I started studying further education, I decided to study human ecology, which is a study of, like, how humans interact with nature and, you know, all the ways that we depend upon it and affect it and stuff. So, but it's quite a depressing discipline. You know, it's not a very rosy picture in many ways. So I didn't really want to continue studying that, even though it was very interesting.
Why was that? Because you felt the bleak outlook that forecast?
Yeah, it's hard to not see it in sort of bleak terms when you look in detail at many of the, you know, ways that humans kind of take something that we depend upon in every way possible and sort of degrade it, or, you know, we're sawing off branches that we're sitting on, and when you get a sort of perspective on how many different ways this is happening at once, then it's kind of hard to be optimistic about things. So I decided to, I moved to England for a little bit, and then I met my fiancé, or sambo. Uh-huh. And then when I came back to Sweden, I decided to study a course in horticultural therapy. So then that brought me onto psychology. That's sort of the little trek.
And do you feel that this field that you're studying now, you can pursue it with a greater degree of optimism than the human ecology field that you were studying?
Yeah, definitely, because I think that the human ecology perspective informs my way of looking at psychology in many ways. You're looking at it from the other way. You know, before I was looking at how humans affect nature in a negative way, and now I'm looking at how nature can affect humans in a positive way, and hopefully that can enable us to then affect nature in a more positive way.
Okay.
So it's a more of a constructive way for me to look at things and more hopeful.
And how, when you finish your studies, have you got any ideas what you would like to do?
Yeah, there's a lot of things. I could see myself working in a therapeutic garden or rehabilitating people, for example, with some kind of burnout, problem. Or I would love to be working with, for example, some kind of lifestyle-related illness, like weight problems or and such. But if you just take the therapeutic environment outdoors,
yeah,
I think you get a lot of things for free. You can activate people and inspire them. And I think that's an interesting approach. So, yeah, there's many other things as well that I'd like to do. I haven't decided. So,
you have your own garden?
I don't at the moment, sadly. I try to run away to my parents' house and I take their dogs for long walks in the woods. Sort of escape modernism.
That gets you fixed, does it, of nature?
Yeah, a little bit anyway.
Can I ask you, why are we talking? Why have you joined the society?
Yeah, I had a train of thought there I'm interested in Taoism, like you mentioned before, and there's a concept in Taoism that really appealed to me when I started encountering it through the work of Ursula K. Le Guin, who's a sort of fantasy sci-fi author. And it's something I've always believed, that creation and ambition can be destructive as well as, you know, creative. And it's also something that obviously in the environmental view of the world, you have that as a very clear example. And I started thinking about why that's so. And I had all these thoughts that there is some kind of feedback mechanism in how modernism works, or our modern society makes us alienated from nature, and then the more alienated we get, the more we can do things that then alienate us further from nature, and it's, yeah, you know, it's a feedback loop. And when I heard about the master and the emissary, that kind of fit very well into that, the idea of there is a force or a mechanism in the brain that is sort of myopic, and we focus on the dead things and the mechanistic aspect. And the more we do that, the more it loses sense of its own place as just one way of looking at things. So, yeah. And when I started reading about that book, I came across a review that Robert had written of it. And that led me to the website, and I found some really interesting thoughts. You know, the middle way philosophy made a lot of intuitive sense to me as a way of people who have quite different, perhaps, cultural things that they carry with them, you peel back some of those sort of dogma that you have, and then you see the things that you have in common. So,
okay. So what is the middle way to you, especially coming from Ian McGilchrist's perspective? And what are your views on, say, integration?
I hope that integration is something that most people can achieve. It's probably not as high up on the sort of steps, you know, the Maslow step of, you know, basic needs. And I don't think it's as high up as maybe it's sometimes seen as, you know, like a luxury. I don't think it necessarily has to be. But the middle way perhaps can give you some tools to further integration without buying into some of the things that, you know, a lot of religion and ideology overall, I don't think it's specific to religion, it's ideology as I see it. Mm-hmm. You buy a bundle of ideas, and then to get the one that says something to you, you have to buy all these things that come with it, and then they confuse you,
mm-hmm.
you know, because you adapt them even though they don't really make any intuitive sense, or they're not based on your experience. So it's like taking one step forward and two steps back, and having some kind of framework to try and decide what makes sense to you and what is just noise.
Yeah.
It's a valuable contribution. So I really, you know, I think that's what appealed to me with the middle way.
Presumably you see integration when you talk about achieving it as not in an ultimate way, but something that you can work towards.
Yeah, more of a process that, I mean, obviously it's not, I don't think it's like a nirvana state. I think I think that as people we kind of make our reality continuously, and we make our own selves that exist in this reality, and it's an ongoing process, and you have to always sort of, you accumulate a lot of stuff that you need to integrate.
Yeah.
So it's never going to be done, I don't think.
Yeah, I noticed on the site you had an interesting discussion recently with Robert around the subject of agnosticism. What did you take from that debate?
I think that it was based in part on a bit of a misunderstanding. I mean, there was some concept I read on a Quaker blog the other day. This woman who talks about single stories. When you look at a person and you see a single story, and for me, somehow on the way, you know, I see myself as an agnostic, but I've recently had I've witnessed a lot of debates with atheists and theists, and how they don't actually talk to each other.
Yeah.
They sort of talk at each other. And I, for some reason, the single story concept is you see an agnostic or an atheist or a theist, and you see the thing that you know about what they believe, and then that's all that you see. And for me, agnosticism became something that was just, I don't think the question of the existence of God is useful.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine, but if that's the only thing that you say isn't useful, then that's just that's what I meant by it's metaphysic in itself.
Yeah.
But if you have, then Robert sort of explained to me that it's more of a general attitude. And I knew this because I've been reading all these things, but it became a single story. You know, I just saw this picture of like, yeah, but why is God different from everything else? But then you're already making some kind of claim there. But if you have that sort of view on the world at large or the universe, that anything outside of experience, then that's I don't have a problem with that. So
that fits that global model.
Yeah.
And the distinction that Robert makes between what he calls soft agnosticism and hard agnosticism, do you think that's a useful distinction?
Yeah, and the way that he explained it, I understood it. When I read about it, I think on Wikipedia, and I shouldn't say that because I don't actually remember what it said, but I got somewhere along the line, I got the kind of the image of hard agnosticism as saying that the question isn't useful, and the soft agnosticism as saying it's a useful question that we probably can't answer. And if that were the distinction, then I would be somewhere in between those two, because I find it a useful question, but I don't think that we can answer it. So, but then I don't know anything about, I don't know how I know that. So yeah, it's a difficult topic.
But yeah. Food for more discussion. I find the subject fascinating too.
It is fascinating.
Yeah. And you mentioned your interest or association with the Quakers. Could you tell us a little about that? And what is, just for a layperson, what is it about the Quakers that you find attractive?
I'm not a Quaker as such. I'm a friend of a friend. As they say, I go to their meetings.
Yeah.
I've been doing that for about 6 months, and I find it really meaningful in my life. There's a silent worship where sometimes people speak from their hearts, as you could call it, and I find that profound. And it's a sort of, it's a type of meditation, but it's not particularly meditation, as in you don't have a, you don't focus on anything. What you do is you wait. And I like that concept of waiting for some kind of insight or hearing about, you know, what are you feeling at the moment? What comes to you? Mm-hmm. And the idea of Quakerism is, I guess, that not all Quakers believe in God, but the concept of God, as they call it, it's in everybody. And I think that's a really nice philosophy, that there isn't a right way and a wrong way.
Could that tie into the idea that although one doesn't believe in God, that doesn't mean that you cannot find God meaningful in an embodied sense?
Yeah, exactly. I think that's, to me, that's how it's, I've never believed in God. And I used to be quite atheist, in, as in I was actively sort of against the idea of believing in God as well. But then I've always also had these feelings of being a small part of something big. And I don't think that that's a God, as maybe perhaps some people view a deity or something. But I do believe that there are interconnections between things, and that there are some kind of context, you know, and it's just a feeling that I have. And so I don't want to make too much of it, but it's meaningful to me. And that is something that comes through in Quaker meetings. You know, I can cultivate that feeling, and it's something that makes me feel good.
Okay.
Yeah.
Would you say, from your experience with the Quakers, that the organization holds any dogmatic positions about things or any metaphysical positions?
Yeah, I think that there are dogmatic. I mean, the Swedish Quakers are very liberal, and but then, of course, that can become an ideology in itself.
Yeah.
I've seen some discussions, mainly online, where people are debating whether it's correct to have a silent worship or it's correct to have a sort of more ministered worship. So of course that then you're starting to talk about right and wrong, and then that's, you know, so I don't think any group is immune. I think that if you know, middle way society needs to be careful as well. Everything can
exactly.
become a dogmatic you know, thing. So yeah. But I do
yep.
think that you can do your best to sort of create the foundation for people to, on your best days, you're not dogmatic. And then we all fall back into defense positions or something. And yeah, I think the Quakers are quite good, as far as I've seen so far, in creating a foundation where people can open up and dare to be free, you know. But of course, it doesn't always succeed.
Why do you think it's important to avoid metaphysics or dogma?
I think that they're kind of, would you say, shorthand? It's
yeah.
It's a very convenient way of making quick kind of, because, you know, we all draw conclusions as we go through life. We have experiences, and then they form these sort of shortcuts. You know, we make judgments. Oh, I probably shouldn't go on that street. It looks a bit dodgy, or whatever, but
yeah.
Then that can be really useful. But then if you start thinking that it must be dodgy, and then the people who live there are dodgy, and then, do you know what I mean? You start having prejudice, and you're not going to be open to that little shop that's on that street. Could be, you know, the coolest bookshop ever, but you're not going to see it because you walk right past it every time. So I think, you know, I don't think metaphysics have to be fatal or anything, but you have to be open to anything that presents itself to you that challenges it, because otherwise you're going to miss important bits of information. So
yeah, that perspective reminds me of the book by Daniel Kahneman, Thinking Fast and Slow.
Mm-hmm.
He makes the point that our intuitive sense, you know, having to make quick decisions, is invariably invaluable a lot of the time. But I like the term he uses. He says we're an organism that is designed to jump to conclusions.
Yeah.
And
that's true, isn't it? And it's useful to do so very often, but if you're never going to question those conclusions, then you're going to be in trouble a lot of the time, and you might not even know it. And that's the, you know, I think that's the scariest part, is it's again this feedback loop that if you go too far down the sunny road that you deem as non-dodgy, then you're going to start missing the people lurking along, you know, behind the post box there, and then, you know, you might be in trouble, and you're not even going to know it until it hits you, because you're so sure that you're safe and fine. And so you're not going to be as much on your guard either, are you? If you're on
exactly,
guard.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, taken the metaphor long far enough, I think. Yeah.
One of the interesting posts that you've done fairly recently, Emily, was one that you did on music and awe, and how awe is, you see, as a, the cultivation of awe is a very important thing in your life. And also, you mentioned that for the middle way too. Could you just summarize that a little bit?
Yeah, I think that it's something, I'm going to steal this now from an article I read the other day. There was an article about Philip Pullman, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
One of my favourite authors.
Oh, really? You should read the article. It's on aeonmagazine.com.
Okay.
And the author quotes Philip Pullman as saying something, you know, he's an atheist, but he seems quite open to experience, actually. And
yeah.
I really admired a lot of things that he said. And he quotes this sort of contrast between Dawkins, Richard Dawkins, saying something about how fairy tales should be banned because they're dangerous and they lead people into sort of magical, unscientific thinking. And then they quoted Einstein as saying that if you want your children to be smart, read them fairy tales. And if you want them to be very smart or intelligent, read them many fairy tales. You know, and I think that it's a very interesting sort of, you can't just rely on the analytical, rational, pick things apart kind of thinking, even if you want to attain goals that, you know, are sometimes best, you know, achieved by that sort of thinking. You have to still have it in a context of the whole world and enchantment and being, you know, joy and curiosity. I think sense of wonder and awe is, it makes us feel humble, and that makes us capable of understanding when we've done something that maybe isn't so good. And it makes us curious. So that opens us up to, we're creative and we can make these little synaptic leaps that, you know, unexpected, and subconscious can put some feedback in. And it's just something that we need as people. I think our history as a species shows that we need to make stories and have metaphors and beauty. And we can't lose that in this strive for efficiency or whatever that's sometimes going on, you know. Like, I don't think that it's clutter along the way. I think it's things that we need to make the full picture.
And do you think the way our society is developing, would you say we have more access to awe or wonder than in the past, or less?
I think there's a bit of a paradox. I think we have more access to it, but then we kind of disenchant it in the way that we take it on board.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of I don't know if this was the same with you, but when I was a teenager and I would get a new album, it was a sort of precious moment, and that and you'd look at the cover and you'd take it out with reverence and play it and it was a special thing. And now I've got an iPod with 10,000 songs on my iPod, and I have a different relationship with those songs. I don't treat a set of songs by an artist in the same way as I used to, with somehow less awe, possibly. Maybe because of information overload. I don't know. Do you experience that?
Yes, definitely. I think that's a very interesting thing that you bring up, because there is sort of a theory about that some people are more sensitive than others. And I think it doesn't just apply to those people, but that there is information overload, and we need to take some time to think about the things we already know before we take on more. And just walking through a city, you have so many images and things to process. And in the past, maybe people saw 200 people in their whole lifetime and maybe saw three pictures or something.
Yeah.
You know, that was the Bible, if they were lucky enough to see a Bible, you know. And now, I mean, I'm not saying that's better, but it's definitely different. So,
yeah. And you also notice that, you know, like when you get onto a news channel, like, say, for the BBC, and invariably they'll have the best photographs of the week. And all these photographs are absolutely fantastic by brilliant artists. But I sometimes feel I'm overloaded with fantastic pictures. And so when it's hard for something to stand out, because everything is so brilliant.
Yes, and I think people get into this thing as well of clicking for the next thing, instead of you find one thing and then you marvel at that. It's the novelty that sort of produces the kick. You know, not the meaning that it carries, but it's the idea that you haven't seen it before, or that it's really cool. And so then you want the next thing that's going to give you that sort of feeling. And I think that's, I mean, I have a tendency to go towards sort of like a Luddite point of view, you know, like primitivist we should all be in cabins in the woods and, you know, have a deliberate life. But I think that, you know, that's just a counter a reaction to something that's, it's, you know, I have a frustration that things are going too far in the other direction. But hopefully there is a middle way of, you know, maybe we can find ways of when this whole, maybe we'll find strategies to deal with all this stuff a little bit better when switching the phones off now and then and not having all 500 channels. You know, you have a couple of channels that you like, or read one blog and not 50 or whatever. So,
well, on that note, Emily, I'd just like to say thank you very much for talking to me today. It's been really interesting. Thank you.
Thank you, Barry. Thank you.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.